Here's the thing. Ever wonder why aspiring authors spend so much time trying to crack the code about how to get published? That's because no one who's in the daily grind like me has put all the pieces together in one place. It's Carly Waters here, and as your senior literary agent on the podcast with 15 years of experience in publishing, selling books, and teaching the business of publishing, I'm here to give you the clarity that will turn this hobby into a career. Inside my course, The Author's Publishing Playbook, we have monthly live Q&A sessions to cover your specific issues. But for the rest, there are over 40 video lessons that equal 10 hours of learning with professionally edited transcripts. The course will solve all your writerly problems, except write your book for you. That's on you. My course is a masterclass designed to teach writers how to prepare, pitch, publish, and promote their book in today's competitive publishing landscape. It's for career-driven writers, aspiring and published, who want to understand how to succeed in the business of books. There are over 20 worksheets, downloads, and plug-and-play templates for editing, querying, and marketing. You get lifetime access for the entire 6-module course as soon as you purchase. As new content gets added, you have access to that as well. Don't forget, there's a mobile app on top of computer access you can learn on the go. Get started today to gain the career you've only dreamed about. And you guys get a discount. So at checkout, carlywaters.com/course, use code POD15. That's code POD15 when you check out for 15% off. That's carlywaters.com/course. Use code POD15. That's code POD15 when you check out for 15% off. See you inside the course.
Hi everyone, this is Cece. If you're a fan of books with hooks, then you've probably heard me use the term interiority. I often catch myself saying things like, these pages need more interiority, or the interiority here needs work. And that's because interiority is a super important element of storytelling. It's what makes books unique. But as it turns out, a lot of you have questions about what exactly is interiority and how to properly weave it into stories, which is why I'm teaching my popular Writing Interiority class in a new 2-day format. We'll meet on Thursday, June 6th at 8 p.m. via Zoom to cover all things interiority, including the difference between interiority and emotions, how interiority is different from telling, how to leverage interiority into plot points, how to strike a balance between interiority and mystery, and more. And then we'll meet again for a live cozy Q&A session on Monday, June 10th, also at 8 p.m. via Zoom, in which you'll have the opportunity to turn your camera on if you choose. If you're interested, check out the link in my bio on Instagram, and I hope to see you there.
Hi there, and welcome to my show, The Shit No One Tells You About Writing. I'm your host, Bianca Murray. Today's guest is the author of the best-selling Be Frank With Me, a finalist for the American Booksellers Association Best Debut Novel Award. She grew up on a farm in Tennessee before moving to New York City, where she worked at Mademoiselle and Glamour magazines. She now lives in Los Angeles with her comedy writer husband, and their two children. It's my pleasure to welcome Julia Claiborne Johnson. So Julia, take us through your journey to publication, everything from the beginning through to where you are now.
Yeah, what happened was, like, when I was a really young person, if you can imagine, the horseless carriage had just been invented. But I was like, oh, I'm going to be a famous writer. And I went to work at Mademoiselle magazine. I worked in the fiction department. And I had to read 10,000 manuscripts a year to find 12 that we could publish for our short story every month. And it was really hard. And it was a good lesson for me because I realized that, like, just because you can write a good sentence doesn't mean you can write a good story. And, you know, some people who are good at stories can't write a good sentence. And then there's some people who can't write at all. And if you don't have a story to tell, when you're going in, you shouldn't write because it's just going to, however beautiful the sentences are, it's going to bore people stiff. So I decided, well, forget that. I'm going to be a magazine writer. And I did that for many years. And then I had children, which is a lesson in itself. And when I was 50 years old, my daughter had to read To Kill a Mockingbird for school. And I thought, oh, well, I'll get it for her. And then she lost it. And then so I thought, well, I'll get another one and we'll read it at the same time. And then we'll have really, you know, touching, insightful conversations about it. Well, that didn't happen. But I hadn't read To Kill a Mockingbird since I was 13. And so when I read it again, and it was a very different time, you know, when I read it this time. And I was like, oh, Boo Radley must be on the autism spectrum, which is not something people thought about back then that I knew of. So my very next thought, because I had two children, was, well, it's a lot easier to write that character than it would be to raise him. And I thought, oh, that's kind of an interesting idea for a book. You know what? I'm going to write that book. And so then I started writing it. And it was, I wouldn't say fun, but it was very gratifying because you can make it turn out the way you wanted it to, which you can't do in life, I have found. So I wrote it in secret. It took me 5 years to write it.
Why in secret?
Just because, like, well, you know, I don't live in New York, so it wouldn't be quite as embarrassing. But, you know, like everybody on earth is writing a novel in New York. Here, and I live in Los Angeles. In Los Angeles, it would be a screenplay. But I was just like, you know what? Nobody needs to know. This is, you know, I'm an old broad. What the hell? Why I don't need to drag this out. Oh, you know, I'm right. And also, Bianca, I don't know if you have found this, but the people who talk about the fact that they're writing a novel almost never actually write it. So I was keeping it to myself, and I finished it, you know, and during the summer when the kids were out of school, I couldn't work on it and vacations and stuff. And so, but I would drive all over LA because there's a lot of driving involved, and I could think about it, which was super helpful. You know, as it turned out. So I would have these long vacations from it. Anyway, I finished it on a Wednesday night. And then I thought, you know what I'm going to do? I'm going to find out who the agent of my favorite writer is. And it was Ann Patchett in the book. I love Bel Canto. It's a great book. I Googled and found out the name of her agent. And I wrote her a letter and I emailed it to her and I went to bed. And the next morning I was up at 6 to get the kids ready to go to school, and she had written me back already. And I was like, whoa, what's happening here? And so she's like, I'd like to see your novel. And so call me as soon as you can. Because I texted her. I said, I'm taking my children to school. So I called her and I said, I just finished it last night. And there are a lot of typos in it. And it's a rough draft. Because I thought she would have it for like 6 months, the letter, before she responded to it. So I sent it to her. She said, I want to see it anyway. I sent it to her. And then that was Thursday. And then on Friday, Hurricane Sandy hit New York City. Oh, my God. What if her iPad runs out of power? And meanwhile, people are drowning, Bianca, and their houses are washing out to sea. And I'm very worried that her iPad's going to run out of power. So anyway, then that, I think it was the following Wednesday. And this is like 7 days after I've typed the end. She's like, I read your manuscript. I love your book. If you'll have me, I'd like to represent you. And I was like, okay. And she said, I'm going to send it out tomorrow. Buckle your seatbelts. It's going to sell in a week. And so this was stunning.
So she didn't feel like it needed any kind of revisions or anything like that.
Hang on.
Okay. Okay. Because I'm just gobsmacked.
It's an unbelievable story. So then I was like, okay, whatever. Because she figured people would see, oh yeah, this is going to be great. We'll just buy it. Nobody bought it. But that was okay, because I would have died of shock. And then my husband would have been a widower, although he would have married again instantly because he is so cute and the funniest man alive. But anyway, so I rewrote it. And it took 2 years to rewrite because, you know, I had a little kid. They weren't that little, but they were smallish. They were still demanding of my time. And I rewrote it and she sent it out. And then it really did sell in a week. So that was my book one. Okay. This is a horrible situation to put yourself in for book two, because I don't know if you know this, but I suspect you might. It is very difficult to write that second novel because you have expectations on you. Because the first one, nobody knew I was writing it. And the second one, people are like, the first thing they'd say instead of hello is like, hey, are you writing a new book? How's it going? And I'd just be like, don't ask me, you know. But I had what I thought was a good idea because in real life, during the Depression in the 1930s, my father had a job working as a divorced cowboy on a dude ranch outside of Reno, where you could get a divorce in 6 weeks if you went and lived on one of these ranches and established Nevada residency. And then that way you were a citizen and they could let you off. So that was a quickie divorce in those days. And I know very little about it otherwise, but I always thought it was really hilarious. And particularly once I grew up and realized, oh, everybody's father did not do this. But I wasn't interested enough in it before he died, because if he were still alive, he'd be 104. He was an older father. So I was my mother was his second wife. But I'd always kind of been thinking about that. So I was like, well, that's what I'm going to write my second novel about. The first novel was in first person, a first person narrator. So I thought, oh, I'm going to grow and stretch as a novelist because I am super brilliant. Because I don't know this, but yeah. So anyway. So I wrote half the book and I sent it to my editor, and she sent it back and she said, well, I don't know. She said, this one, you know, you're all like voice and throwaway jokes. And this third person is not working for you. So no. And I was like, oh, geez. So I started all over again. And I wrote half the novel. And I sent it to her. And, you know, this has happened. The entire experience of this was 3 years from start to finish because my kids were bigger. They needed me less. And, you know, I was a professional writer. And so I sent her the second version. And she said, I love the prologue. I hate the rest of it.
Oh my God.
But the prologue, Bianca, the prologue was 6 pages long. So I was like, but she bought it based on the 6 pages. She didn't pay a lot of money for it, you know, considering how much a brilliant writer such as myself was worth. But it was a pig and a poke. I mean, she didn't know what she was going to get. So, and I don't even remember what was different about the second version, because it must have been forgettable because I don't remember it at all, aside from those 6 pages. So the 6 pages was the jumping off page, the jumping off spot. And so then I rewrote it again. And what I learned to my dismay, it's in second person. I thought it was in first person, but he's telling the story to somebody. And if you tell a book to a you, it's second person, even though he hardly ever says you.
I feel like it's a, just for the listeners, I feel like it's kind of a hybrid because he refers to himself a lot as, you know, like the I as well, but he is telling the story to somebody, and I won't ruin it for everybody out there as to who he's telling the story to, but it becomes like kind of a hybrid of I and you.
Here's the thing, but I didn't realize it was second person. And she's like, yeah, it's second person. But so in my mind, I was always going to write it in first person. So I thought for the whole book, and then the last chapter, when you, because there's information he doesn't have, and he's going to find out that missing, those missing pieces, and that was going to be third person. So my editor, who is a brilliant genius, a real brilliant genius, was like, you know, it has to be second person all the way through. So that last chapter has to be in second person. So there's no way for him to know the stuff he has to find out. So it was not a fun experience. I wrote the end maybe 5,000 times. And the last version I wrote of the end, I had written several. And it was the coronavirus that started. So my children had been sent home from college, and I was never alone in my house anywhere ever. And so I had turned in yet another version of the last chapter. And I was sitting at the kitchen table, and I was like, hey, wait a minute. I'm alone in here. And so I started crying because I was like, I can't write it again. I cannot write it again. I don't have it in me. And my daughter comes breezing into the kitchen and she's like, Mama, are you crying? And I was like, no, my eyes are just really tired. She's like, no, it's okay. If you're crying, it's all right. And I said, well, if you want to know the truth. And she's like, oh no, I don't want to hear what it's about. So I had to laugh. And then the next day, my editor wrote me and she said, I love the new ending. So thank God. But there were points when I was writing that book where I just thought, I'll never finish it. I'll just never finish it. And, you know, if I stepped out into the street and got hit by a car, like any accident that could have happened to me, I'd think, but then I don't have to finish my novel.
Something that resonates so much with me is the fact that, you know, you write your first novel and everyone tells you that your first novel should be so difficult because you don't know what you're doing. You're finding your way into novel writing, you learning as you're going along. So I fully expected my second book to be so much easier to write than the first.
No. I thought it was a million times harder because there's expectations, because if you didn't finish the first one, who would be the wiser? You know, I guess if I'd sold it ahead of time and had an advance that I had to give back, that would be awfully embarrassing. But man, that second one almost killed me. And my editor, the brilliant genius, was like, look, a lot of my writers are going through this right now. They're writing second books. They all are struggling. It is the hardest book you'll ever write because the first book you've kind of been writing your whole life. Like you think about it. Like, and so this is funny. My agent has an adult daughter who lived with us for a while. When she moved to California, she went to work at a talent agency out here. So I said, let her stay with us at first because Los Angeles is so sprawling and she'll get some apartment that she thinks is close to work, but it's not close to work. And she'll think it's a nice neighborhood, but it's a horrible neighborhood. So let her live with me for a while and then she can find a place to live. So she was my fake daughter and it was the greatest. She loved me. She thought all my stories were funny because she had heard none of them. She read the book and the advance copy. And so she already lived somewhere else by then. So she came in to our house because she comes, well, she doesn't now, but she used to come to our house every week, once a week for dinner so we could keep up. She threw the advance copy down on the table and she said, well, all your jokes are in this one. I don't know what's going to be in the second one. And I was like, they had to be in this one because there might have been no second one.
What I'm especially interested in was you finding your way into the character's voice, because as the book is now, Better Luck Next Time, Ward has such a singular voice. Mm-hmm. He's speaking to somebody who the reader doesn't know who it is that he's relaying this tale to. And, mm-hmm. you know, when I started the book and realized that this is what you were doing, I thought to myself, oh gosh, is this going to work? Because everything else essentially becomes backstory, as opposed to us just being in the moment. We know that he's, you know, quite old in the future and he's remembering back on his life. And so I was thinking that would really slow down the momentum, take away the immediacy of what was happening. But that didn't happen at all, which was absolutely amazing. So finding your way into that voice, because I tell all my writing students that it's a process of trial and error, you know, and like mm-hmm. you said, you started off in the third person, then you went to, you know, you had the prologue. Was the prologue in the second person, and that's why your editor loved the prologue?
Yes, it was in the second person. It's the right. It's more or less the same prologue. It's a little bit different, but and it used to start with the joke, which I really like. But she's like, that's a hard joke to start on because people get the wrong idea, because it used to be, you know, some men are born gigolos, but others have it thrust upon them. But now there's a paragraph in front of that. I mean, you're going to find that out anyway. But you know, she's like, that's a little harsh to start with. That's like, but yes, it's just. It made me laugh. So, but it's more or less the way it was. There's a line in there somewhere that says something like, you know, when you get to be old, things that happened to you yesterday start seeming more real than what's happening to you now. And I feel like that all the time. Like stuff that happened to me in my 20s, it's like it just happened. If it happened last week, if it's what I had for breakfast today, can't help you.
And I think that's something that you were obviously trying to bring alive in this character, was how vivid memories can be and how regrets from the past and things we didn't do and things we wanted to do and things that we wonder, had we taken that road, how our worlds would have worked out. And Ward is this kind of character. You know, there's kind of this point in the story where his story could have gone one or two ways. And he says throughout that he doesn't have regrets and that he, you know, the way his life has ended up, he's very happy with the way his life has ended up, but it could have been very, very different. So was that something when you sat down to write, that was something that you wanted to tackle? A person later in life looking back on their life and trying to make sense of it?
Yes, because I should have said this part. I didn't even think about it. Sort of how, I mean, I always loved the idea of my father's experience, and this is not his at all. Like, all I know, it's just the jumping off place. I don't know what his was like. I tried to find some trace of him there in Reno at the Historical Society. Nothing. Anyway, a few months before that, I had been talking to one of my friends who, I have a delightful husband who is just the best. He's so funny. Everything about him is magnificent. He's my second husband. My first husband was a nice man, but not the right husband for me. And one of my friends is married to somebody who is just as nice as Chris is. Fabulous guy. And she said, you know, whether you're happy or not, it doesn't depend on your career success. It's on if you marry the right person. Because if you marry the right person, you'll be happy and you can deal with anything. Other problems. But if you're unhappy at home, you're never really gonna be happy. And I was like, oh, that's so true, because I hadn't thought about it. And I couldn't stop thinking about how just that one choice alters everything. And my mother was my father's second wife. So if he'd stuck it out with the first wife, I wouldn't exist. If I'd stuck it out with my first husband, my children wouldn't exist. And I probably would have slit my wrist or cut his throat, one or the other. And he was a nice man. He was just not right. But it's just like, and the chances, because there's like a whole, in this book, there's a whole gambling motif, because it really is such a gamble, because you don't go in knowing that you've made the right choice. And it's funny, because there's a speech in there where the woman who runs the ranch says, everybody goes in with their best, putting their best foot forward, you know, blah, blah, blah. And that page 45, or perhaps 47, Bianca, I wrote it for 3 months straight, all day long, typing all day, because I knew it was so important to the whole idea of the novel, and I couldn't get it right. It was just killing me. And I somehow managed to not give up. I don't know how. And one day it just like came, and I was like, oh, thank God, there it is. Because that's the crux of the novel.
You nailed that as well, because she's such an amazing character. You know, so wise. Everything that she said, like her outlook to life was absolutely amazing. But also the man that she was with, they were just such a perfect, perfect couple. And yet they're running this like divorce ranch.
But I thought that, well, that's really nice, because you need to think, well, there's a reason I'm going through this. Because if you were staying with somebody who was, like tore each other's heads off every day. You'd be like, oh, never get married again. So
yeah, they were the aspirational couple. I feel like the women who were at the ranch were kind of licking their wounds. And then they could look at this couple and be like, mm-hmm. well, this is what I want. This is why I'm getting divorced, to hopefully go out and find this kind of partnership.
I know. And then if it works, oh my God, it's so amazing. So, and I'm almost glad, like I didn't particularly enjoy the whole experience of the first marriage, first divorce, but it made me appreciate the second, because I've been married to Chris for almost 30 years now. So, and it really made me just every day I get up and think, oh my God, I got so lucky. I didn't even have to pay him to marry me either. So, but yeah, like, I would, I totally would. So.
We just registered my youngest kid for kindergarten. I cannot believe it. One of the tricky things about my kids being in French immersion school and not having French as a language myself is I'm honestly worried about how I'm going to assist with homework as they get bigger. They're young now, but I see it coming. We are honestly so lucky though to live in a city that's bilingual, and we have bilingual friends and Francophone friends. So I know it's going to be easy for our kids to pick it up. Me, on the other hand, I am worried about me. I grew up somewhere where French class was not taken seriously, and now I have to make up the difference. And that's where Rosetta Stone comes in. As the most trusted language learning program available on desktop or as an app, it really immerses you in the language you want to learn. Rosetta Stone teaches through immersion, which is a proven way to learn a language. Instead of memorizing and drilling vocabulary words, you learn by matching audio from native speakers to visuals, reading stories, participating in dialogues, and other practical language skills to fast track your ability to communicate fluently. There are no English translations in the product. You're honestly getting trained to listen, speak, read, write, and think in your new language, which is what everybody wants. Rosetta Stone users especially love the speech recognition feature. As you practice speaking, Rosetta Stone uses advanced voice recognition technology to match your audio, the audio from native speakers, and then give you feedback on how well you're pronunciating the words, so you can really hone those pronunciations. It offers 25 languages, from Spanish, French, Italian, German, Chinese, Korean, Japanese, even Dutch, Arabic, and Polish. This is the best language program because they have been an expert in the language learning field for 30 years and used by millions. Thousands of companies and government organizations use Rosetta Stone to support language training online. Of all the apps, Rosetta Stone uses the best speech recognition technology, so it compares your sound waves to those of a native speaker for better feedback to improve. They have a patented speech recognition engine called True Accent, which is built into the program. As you practice speaking, you'll get feedback on how well you're pronunciating words. The other language learning apps use speech recognition to detect what you said, but Rosetta Stone tells you how well you said it compared to native speakers. It's like having a personal trainer for your accent. Think about the cost of a one-month language course. Think about the cost of one-hour private tutoring sessions. With Rosetta Stone, you enjoy lifetime membership and accessibility on desktop or app. We have a special offer for you guys. That's 50% off. That's a lifetime access to 25 language courses on Rosetta Stone for 50% off. This is a steal. Do not put off learning that language. There is no better time than right now to get started. For a very limited time, the Shit No One Tells You About Writing listeners can get Rosetta Stone's lifetime membership for 50% off. That we want you guys to go visit rosettastone.com/today. That's 50% off unlimited access to 25 language courses for the rest of your life. Redeem your 50% off at rosettastone.com/today.
Are you looking for beta readers, some of whom might potentially become writing group members down the line? Are you wanting to be matched up with those writing in a similar genre or time zone so they can critique your work as you critique theirs at the same time? Your manuscript doesn't have to be complete to sign up for this 3,000-word evaluation. This particular matchup will be open to registrations from now until the 2nd of June, with the matchup emails going out on the 3rd of June. For more information and to register, go to biancamaray.com, look for the beta reader matchup page, and please spread the word. The more writers we have signed up, the better the matches will be. Can we talk about the humor in the books? And I mean, obviously, just talking to you, you're a very funny person. This is why you've married a funny person as well. I find that funny people are attracted to each other, people with a really good sense of humor. Have you got advice for our listeners in terms of how to approach writing humor? Because something you said earlier has stuck with me, in that, you know, your editor said this is just a bunch of one-liners.
You're good at voice and throwaway jokes, because a throwaway joke, that's where all the funny stuff comes from. Well, for one thing, I will say this. When I went on tour with the first book, people would ask me all the time if my husband wrote my jokes. And I'd be like, excuse me, I too am funny. Yeah, he used to write for Beavis and Butthead. And one of the, my, which is, you may be too young to remember, but my great point of pride is I came up with a plot for one of the classic Beavis and Butthead things. It's called Tired, where they're just rolling down a hill inside a tire. I was like, that would be pretty funny. So it helps when you're writing humor if you have an exquisitely developed sense of the ridiculous and the ability to laugh at yourself, which not everybody has. And I wonder if like all funny writers do. I have to think of that. I'll have to give this some thought. But like a lot of times when I would approach something that like a scene I was going to do, I'd be like, what would be the most hilarious and mortifying way this could happen? And so then I would write down a bunch of different things and just sit there and look at them. But, you know, I don't know. Is it like this with you? Like once you get started, it kind of takes over and it's like you're channeling it. Like it's like they're talking to me instead of me saying, this is what you're going to say.
Oh, no, definitely. But sometimes you need to kind of beat them back because, you know, you, especially in a book like this, this book wasn't as funny as your first book. Because like you say, you got in all your jokes into your first book. That was really, really hilarious. This book, I feel like either your editor edited out a lot of your humor, which is what happened to me with my second book. I tried to put in as much humor into my second book as I had in my first. And my editor just said, no, it's losing the poignancy. It's becoming all about the jokes and we're not getting those sucker punch emotional moments. And I feel like in this book, in Better Luck Next Time, there's some hilarious, hilarious moments that feel you can just picture them unfolding. They'd make an excellent movie or an excellent, you know, TV show, and it's rumpy and it's very comedic. And then there's these quieter moments that are, you know, the sucker punch moments. So do you find that you have to kind of rein yourself in, or is that something your editor helps you with?
I think she cut some jokes that I thought, oh, that's a really good joke. But then I was like, oh, I think there can be too many jokes. And you're talking to me, you know, I can't resist every opportunity to make a joke about something. Frank was in the beginning of somebody's life. And this is written by somebody who's, it's not written by, but it's about somebody who's at the end of their life. And my mother used to be a doctor. So a lot of it, it's really, the character is her a lot. Because with her compassion and everything and the way she was. And she was in a retirement home and has been for quite some time. She has dementia. So luckily she can't remember how long it's been since any of us have seen her because she, you know, can't remember like me. I feel like she can't remember what happened yesterday. So she doesn't know we haven't been there in a long time. But anyway, back in her day, she was like the center of the community and she delivered thousands of babies and she took care of everybody. And like, and now to just be shuffled off to the side because she needs more care than any of us can give, you know, because she really needs somebody with her 24/7. So that to me seems very hard. So, and you know, the guy in this book, our narrator, isn't really that old. He's in his 70s, but he has really bad spinal stenosis, which my mother's best friend in medical school also had. So he couldn't practice medicine anymore. And it just killed him that he couldn't do that. He also lived to be very old. So to me, that's just like, so wrenching. So I think that's part of why the book isn't as funny, because it's a less funny situation to be in. So anyway, but it seems to me this book is super heartbreaking, but at the same time, there is hope and things that happen and it happened so that it's not just unremittingly sad. So
there were moments that were really laugh out loud funny. I absolutely loved it. For me, I'm a fan of the kind of book that can take you on a roller coaster of emotions. I like a book that, you know, one page you're kind of feeling it in your chest and you're trying to stop tears from falling. And then three pages later, you're laughing your ass off. Because to me, that's the same as life, you know, and like this year has taught us that is the way it is. And if you don't have a damn sense of humor, I don't know how the hell you've gotten through this year.
Oh, my God.
Because there's so much awful stuff, but you have to laugh in between. And I feel like your book captured that part of life so utterly perfectly. But for me, it was more wondering about how, as a comedic writer, as someone who's so inherently funny, how you just temper that. Because, you know, I have students who've written humor. And I mean, it's comedic timing, isn't it?
Yeah, because you can't ram it down people's throat. And you know, it's funny because my husband is a comedy writer. And they all say that the comedy is tragedy plus time. And you're like, truer words never spoken, because it's that old thing about someday we're going to laugh about this. But you know, some things you never do quite laugh about. But you know, if you don't have a sense of humor, I don't know how you stand it. So I don't think I answered your question at all. a boyfriend once many years ago who, like, just everything was a joke all the time, just 24/7. And I was just like, dude, you got to let it rest. And it's when my editor did the final edit, she cut out a lot of jokes. And I was upset at first, but then I was thinking about that guy. I was like, oh my God, I would just want to say to him, just give it a rest. And so I was just like, fine, just take it out. Just take it out. As long as the book's more than 70 pages long, I guess it still qualifies as a book. And there were like maybe two things that I insisted on hanging on to. I don't know what they are, but I'm sure there must have been a couple. And it really did make a huge difference. It made it much more wrenching, like you said, because, you know, you could really see what I was after better. Because it was just like, you know, because how they say jokes are a defense mechanism. I was sort of trying to defend myself from how heartbreaking I found this book.
Yeah.
But I needed to just roll with it. So that's a hard lesson to learn.
And I feel like that's exactly what I was doing with my first novel as well. That was an incredibly difficult book for me to write. So I needed like the humor to balance it out and just keep going. Because sometimes writing is a form of therapy, you know, it's like just suddenly sitting in front of a therapist and just letting it all out. And even worse, because other people are going to read it afterwards. It's not like it's just between, you know, you and your therapist. And your ex-boyfriend sounds like Chandler on Friends.
Exactly. Yeah. Jeez.
So in terms of advice to new writers, because there's so much emphasis put on young writers, I find, in the industry. All of these articles are, you know, writers under 30 or writers who are debuting novels at 27. So pressure gets put on new writers who feel like, oh my God, I haven't written my novel by the time I'm 30. And therefore, I'm not going to write this novel and it's too late for me to become a writer. So, I mean, you, it can be done. You published after you were 50. Is that right? How old were you when your debut came out?
By the time Be Frank With Me came out, I was 55. And I'll tell you something. There's a writer, you might not know her. She's British. Her name's, well, she's dead now, so you don't know her personally. Her name's Mary Wesley. And her husband died, I think. Like, she was like Mary, and suddenly she had to support herself. So she's like, well, what am I going to do? I'll write some novels. So she wrote like between 70 and 90. She wrote like six novels. One of them is called A Chamomile Lawn. They made a PBS series out of it. I've never seen it, but I know it exists. And the only one of her books I've read is The Chamomile Lawn. What was great about it was it's people from childhood until their senescence. And because she had lived through all those parts, she understood what each part was like. And I think if you're 26 and you're trying to write a guy who's in his 70s, who's in a nursing home and has to get around with a walker, it's not going to sound right. But believe me, I know what it feels like to hurt when you stand up and, you know, and you've been around that more. And I think it's such a gift to not try to start to writing until you're as old as I am. I'm saying that because that's what I chose. But it's not like I did it on purpose, but I didn't have a story. I didn't feel like I had a story. And I think it's really hard on the really young people if they haven't really done a lot of living outside of the normal parameters of people who are writers. Like, what are they doing for material? And that's why I think a lot of them are super serious and, like, you know, people are junkies and, you know, because you can understand that when you're 26. Or, you know what it's really like, Bianca? You know how, like, there are a lot of, like, really handsome actors who sort of become like Alec Baldwin is one. He was so handsome when he was young, but he was never really that funny until he got old. Right. Because the thing that people are like valuing you for doesn't matter anymore. And then you can let yourself go. And I think that really helps with your comedy. I don't know. I just thought of that. It sounds reasonable. Let's go with it.
Very wise. We're going with that.
Same with voice, because by the time you're old, you have overheard a lot of other people's conversations. And when you're older, you're not as like caught up in yourself because you've had to have close contact with other people more. And so I felt like I did. I had a better grasp on how other people talk. So I thought that was super helpful. So the bottom line is really just wait till you're old. Well, but you can start now, honey.
You had way more life experience. You know the stories that you're passionate about, because that's also something I tell my students. Don't just sit down and go, oh, this sounds interesting, let me start writing. It has to be something that's super compelling, that you feel passionate about, that you want to spend 3 to 5 years with, because otherwise you'll spend a year with it and just go, oh God, no, I'm sick of the story. I don't feel compelled to keep writing it. So I also find that the older we get, the more we know what issues are super important to us, the more we feel we feel things so much more deeply the older we get as well. And I think that translates as well into writing. So all this to say, to the readers out there who are in their 40s, who are in their 50s, who are in their 60s. Remember that Delia Owens published Where the Crawdads Sing in her 70s. And it's been the biggest publishing phenomenon of the last sort of decade. So there's no point at which you should give up or that you're too old. Just keep at it. Is there any kind of takeaway, anything that you know you've learned or any other advice that you'd like to share that you would have liked to know when you were on this journey earlier?
I have a couple of things. One is when I decided I was going to write that first novel, I was like, oh, I better teach myself how to write a novel. And I'd had a teacher once named Richard Yates who wrote Revolutionary Road and Easter Prairie, a lot of super depressing novels. But I read his biography, and when he was 13, he decided he wanted to be a writer. And so he typed the entire Great Gatsby just so he could internalize the rhythms of a novel. And I was like, oh my God, that's such a good idea. So I didn't do that, but I got a notebook and I took my three favorite novels at the time. It was Bel Canto, I Capture the Castle. Have you ever read that? So good. And The Hunger Games, which is very well written. And I wrote down everything that happened on every page. And then that helped me sort of go, oh, this is how it goes. And this is how the pacing is. And the other thing I would say, which was very important, was I would read some novel and think, oh, this is such a lousy novel. How the heck did this novel get published? And then one day I went, wait a minute. I know how. They finished it. Step one. If you don't finish it, it's never going to get published. And that was so valuable to me. I mean, I'm joking, but you just have to persevere. So I really think the ability to persevere almost matters more than talent, because there's so many talented writers, brilliant talented writers who cannot finish a book. So they might as well not be talented at all. So that's really the ability to just stick with it and not give up.
And that's it for today's episode. If you have any questions about writing or publishing, please email me at theshitaboutwriting@gmail.com. And I'll do my best to get them answered for you. I hope you'll join us for next week's show. In the meantime, keep at it. Remember, it just takes one yes.
Here's the thing. Ever wonder why aspiring authors spend so much time trying to crack the code about how to get published? That's because no one who's in the daily grind like me has put all the pieces together in one place. It's Carly Waters here, and as your senior literary agent on the podcast with 15 years of experience in publishing, selling books, and teaching the business of publishing, I'm here to give you the clarity that will turn this hobby into a career. Inside my course, The Author's Publishing Playbook, we have monthly live Q&A sessions to cover your specific issues, but for the rest, there are over 40 video lessons that equal 10 hours of learning with professionally edited transcripts. The course will solve all your writerly problems, except write your book for you. That's on you. My course is a masterclass designed to teach writers how to prepare, pitch, publish, and promote their book in today's competitive publishing landscape. It's for career-driven writers, aspiring and published, who want to understand how to succeed in the business of books. There are over 20 worksheets, downloads, and plug-and-play templates for editing, querying, and marketing. You get lifetime access for the entire 6-module course as soon as you purchase. As new content gets added, you have access to that as well. Don't forget, there's a mobile app on top of computer access you can learn on the go. Get started today to gain the career you've only dreamed about. And you guys get a discount. So at checkout, carlywaters.com/course, use code POD15, that's code POD15, when you check out for 15% off. That's carlywaters.com/course. Use code POD15. That's code POD15 when you check out for 15% off. See you inside the course.
Hi, everyone. This is Cece. If you're a fan of books with hooks, then you've probably heard me use the term interiority. I often catch myself saying things like, these pages need more interiority, or the interiority here needs work. And that's because interiority is a super important element of storytelling. It's what makes books unique. But as it turns out, a lot of you have questions about what exactly is interiority and how to properly weave it into stories, which is why I'm teaching my popular Writing Interiority class in a new 2-day format. We'll meet on Thursday, June 6th at 8 p.m. via Zoom to cover all things interiority, including the difference between interiority and emotions, how interiority is different from telling, how to leverage interiority into plot points, how to strike a balance between interiority and mystery, and more. And then we'll meet again for a live cozy Q&A session on Monday, June 10th, also at 8 p.m. via Zoom, in which you'll have the opportunity to turn your camera on if you choose. If you're interested, check out the link in my bio on Instagram. and I hope to see you there.
Here's the thing. Ever wonder why aspiring authors spend so much time trying to crack the code about how to get published? That's because no one who's in the daily grind like me has put all the pieces together in one place. It's Carly Waters here, and as your senior literary agent on the podcast with 15 years of experience in publishing, selling books, and teaching the business of publishing, I'm here to give you the clarity that will turn this hobby into a career. Inside my course, The Author's Publishing Playbook, we have monthly live Q&A sessions to cover your specific issues. But for the rest, there are over 40 video lessons that equal 10 hours of learning with professionally edited transcripts. The course will solve all your writerly problems, except write your book for you. That's on you. My course is a masterclass designed to teach writers how to prepare, pitch, publish, and promote their book in today's competitive publishing landscape. It's for career-driven writers, aspiring and published, who want to understand how to succeed in the business of books. There are over 20 worksheets, downloads, and plug-and-play templates for editing, querying, and marketing. You get lifetime access for the entire 6-module course as soon as you purchase. As new content gets added, you have access to that as well. Don't forget, there's a mobile app on top of computer access you can learn on the go. Get started today to gain the career you've only dreamed about. And you guys get a discount. So at checkout, carlywaters.com/course, use code POD15, that's code POD15 when you check out for 15% off. That's carlywaters.com/course, use code POD15, that's code POD15 when you check out for 15% off. See you inside the course.
Hi everyone, this is Cece. If you're a fan of books with hooks, then you've probably heard me use the term interiority. I often catch myself saying things like, these pages need more interiority, or the interiority here needs work. And that's because interiority is a super important element of storytelling. It's what makes books unique. But as it turns out, a lot of you have questions about what exactly is interiority and how to properly weave it into stories, which is why I'm teaching my popular Writing Interiority class in a new 2-day format. We'll meet on Thursday, June 6th at 8 p.m. via Zoom to cover all things interiority, including the difference between interiority and emotions, how interiority is different from telling, how to leverage interiority into plot points, how to strike a balance between interiority and mystery, and more. And then we'll meet again for a live cozy Q&A session on Monday, June 10th, also at 8 p.m. via Zoom, in which you'll have the opportunity to turn your camera on if you choose. If you're interested, check out the link in my bio on Instagram, and I hope to see you there.